Priatelia, ak sa vám páči tento podcast How I Met My Architect, budem veľmi rád, ak za neho práve teraz zahlasujete v súťaži Podcast roka 2024. Odborná porota ho totiž vybrala do užšej nominácie v kategórii Ateliér. Hlasovanie prebieha do 16. júna a všetky informácie nájdete na webe Rádia Express alebo na oficiálnych stránkach súťaže Podcast roka 2024. Ďakujem veľmi pekne.
Welcome everybody, I'm Peter Rostl, Slovakian architect, and you are listening to podcast about architecture called How I Met My Architect. Right now I'm in Milan on my 2-month architectural trip, which is supported by Goethe Institute and also Culture Moves Europe. In Milan, it's always really good opportunity to talk with some Italian local architects. And today, my guest will be well-known Italian architect Cino Zucchi. Hi, Cino.
Ciao to everybody.
Let's warm up a little bit. Very quick question. You are doing architecture more than 40 years. So let's make a very, very short description. What is your studio focusing on in a really broad field of architecture?
Our studio, which is middle-sized in European terms, you have one-man bands and you have very, very big orchestra. We are in between. So we mixed certain elements of craftsmanship and in a way traditional, very classical way of doing architecture with the modern organization of the work, which also is quite different since I started. You know, I am a person who completely saw the information technology revolution. Many, many years ago, when I was very young, I studied at MIT and I took a course of artificial intelligence. It's an interesting topic. This was 1977, and I saw the birth, in a way, of the first researches about artificial intelligence, but the internet was not even there yet. So during my lifespan, the way we work changed very much. Coming back to us, there was a famous Swiss, actually, artist, Johann Heinrich Fussli, who said, in art, many beautiful things are found by chance, but conserved by choice. I think this also happened in his life. Many times, each person is subjected to many occasions, but our character, in a way, reinforces some things and not others. So it's an interesting combination between randomness and direction. This is true also in professional life. For example, certainly at a certain point, the winning of a very important competition was 1995, so almost, I would say 30 years ago, in Venice. In a way, changed a bit the scale of our studio because what by chance that we won this competition. A former industrial area is called the Jungans. They used to make watches and military apparel. And the story, the political story is very complicated, as many Italian stories, but we were invited among very important architects at the time. It was a private competition, actually. I feel I became an adult in my profession through difficulties, and this was one of them. So we have a studio which is not focused on a specific topic. We are good in doing housing. We're good in doing offices. We did, for example, the Lavazza headquarters in Torino, which is not just an office building, but a big urban renovation, was also the fruit of winning competition. We do also smaller scale things. We did some shops or interiors, but also we do a lot of urban design. So I like to go from one scale to the other, one theme to the other. In any way, we consider each project very special. So we don't have a specialization. We do have a sensibility or an attitude.
But how tough is for you to switch between those scales? Because when you have to solve the problem or design something in the interior and in a master plan, how tough is it for you?
Quite complicated and long way to explain what I think about. Let's say in the old times, architecture had what you could call a theory, even from Palladio, Vitruvius, and so on, but also it had, up to a point, a set of shared forms in the European tradition, was mostly the classical orders and this kind of thing. Not only that, of course, you have a lot of architecture who goes away from that, Gothic architecture and so on. But just to say that for a long period, the set of classical orders, you know, Toscanic, Doric, Ionic, Corinthian composite, was some kind of shared language which had to be composed, but nobody really discussed the essence of it. So, for some reason, at the beginning of the last century, around 1920, the architects felt all this set was not useful anymore to solve contemporary problems. The basis of what you could call functionalism, you know, can call in many ways, is that the modern movement comes from obliteration of traditional forms. I'm not a traditionalist. I'm just saying that for a moment, say, I don't want to look at that. It only clutters my mind. I want to create what is called an approach or method, some kind of capital M method. So I get some inputs. And if I apply a scientific, for a moment, was not necessarily scientific, but it tend to look at the scientific as a, some kind of proof of objectivity method to a problem, that the form will result. Let me make an example. It could say, if I have to do a school, I calculate the number of kids, I see the course of the sun, I look at the strength of material, I look at my budget, I look at the geology of the soil. I put all these things together and in a method, and then the result is the shape of the school. So, in a way, at the end of the process, the form only comes at the end, is the result of a correct process of data. This is what Levi-Strauss in English is called the Savage Minds, is a book by the anthropologist Levi-Strauss, called the attitude of the engineer. He makes an opposition between the engineer and the bricoleur. He says the engineer, as an idealized figure, is somehow who has no formal prejudice. It applies, again, a procedure to events. A bricoleur, on the contrary, is somebody who finds a box of given forms, like a Robinson Crusoe on an island who tries to make some kind of house out of the boat, and just by manipulating or assembling forms, he gets the results. So these two opposite figures, engineer and bricoleur, he sees the poles of artistic creation. Going back to us, in the last maybe 20 or 30 years, in many, many, many lectures I heard by my colleagues architects, I heard a lot of time this phrase. And the tone which I say it is like a little bit like snobby. I'm not interested in forms. I'm interested in strategies. They say, I'm not interested in forms. I'm interested in strategies. Which means form is something bad and something arbitrary. And a lot of people are trying to convince that the form they arrive to is out of mathematical formula, the course of the wind tunnel, these things. Since they are afraid of the arbitrariness of form, they convinced us the form they make is not just an invention, it's the result of some kind of reasoning. A lot of architects do that. So it's a sort of a new age view with computers, you know, with the simulation of, in a way, functionalism. On the contrary, I think that design is the invention of a form which is not logically contained into the data, and then the check of this form with all the data. This is something Christopher Alexander says in Notes on the Synthesis of Form. For example, if you do a competition, the program is the same for all the architects. I do a lot of competition. when I look after, we just did a competition in Brno for the Jewish Museum and Cultural Center, and the other invited people were Toyo Ito, who by the way won. And when I do a competition, and then I'm very curious to see what my opponents and competitors have done, if the process would be just insert the data into a method, you wouldn't need a competition. Paradoxically, the fact that competition exists, it means you can take the same functional program or site and interpret in the same way. So I think in the end, the act of architecture is an interpretation. When I say interpretation, it means that it's not just an invention and it's not just data processing, it's in between. An interpretation looks at the situation very closely, but then you can push one element more than one other. It means to say that if we take an example in the other arts, particularly music or film, which I find particularly both close to my work, you have two kind of equally good artists. Artists who always do, they tend to find specific topics or problems or motives, and they work more and more on it, but you see some kind of resemblance between the products, maybe deepening the theme. And I would put in this case maybe Joan Baez in the music, maybe Federico Fellini in the movies. I think modern architects who did that are, for example, I'm very affectionate to Franco Albini in Italy, who did very different projects. In a way, Rafael Moneo, in a more recent way, does it. Certainly, Enzo de Meuron do it. I think they are among, in my sensibility, the best architects of this century, because they always surprise me. They can go, sometimes they do a barn. When they do a restoration, it's almost not there sometimes. Sometimes they go super expressionistic. Every time I see a project of Enzo de Meuron, I am surprised by the formal output, because I find it is very specific, not only contextual, but it's like finding a theme. While other architects, which I also like, they are more easy to... It would be more easy to do a fake Toyo Ito, no, sorry, Tadawando, or, you know, Zahadid project in the style of Zahadid. Even in the studio of Zahadid today, they told me they use artificial intelligence, which goes back to the project statistically. In a way, they are using it like almost Midjourney-like. So the present Zahadid studio, I talk because I spoke with a person who's the information technology manager, they go back and find some kind of language of Zahadid and then they reapply it. I'm not saying this is wrong, okay? I know, very good project by Zahadid, but I feel closer to what I said before. Going back to your thing, I don't think I have a unity of method. I do have a sensibility, and I tend to invent every time some kind of interpretation or key to the project, of course using my experience, because, you know, you do, but never applying it mechanically. I would use the word interpretation and character as two fundamental words who could define the way we work.
And now when you are talking about creating your architecture, are you somehow transforming the Italian tradition from those masters, as you said, like Luigi Figini, Pollini, Caccia Dominioni, or Gio Ponti, or those Italians? Are you somehow transforming the tradition to your projects?
That's a very also interesting question, because I was raised in a house by Caccia Dominioni. I have a small picture in my wallet, which is me, I was 8 years old, next to Caccia Dominioni, because he designed the house of my parents, and he wrote a small note to my baby Chino. I have his autograph, so sometimes I keep it as a thing. So Certainly, I think I've been influenced somehow to some kind of Italian way to modernism, particularly after the Second World War. So the architecture goes from the 50s to the 70s, because in my feeling, it contained both an optimistic idea of the modern world, some kind of modern living, and also this issue of tradition in a non-conservative way. Tradition, I quote Paul Valéry, who's also a big, he says, the phrase to renew a tradition is a fake one. The essence of tradition is almost an unconscious continuity. In the moment we become conscious of a tradition, we means we don't have it anymore. So the project, what we do, is something who can be subjected to judgment as a new one. I think in a modern world, closing yourself in a small Europe is a risk. Europe feels endangered by the big changes of the world, you know, the East and so on, tends to go back to some kind of good old things. And this is interesting on one way, because I love Europe. I feel very, very European. But it could have some kind of conservative hint. You see the modern generation, sometimes of all countries in Europe, going back. I went to Munich, there was a wedding, and everybody was very elegant men, all dressed in lederhosen, you know, the leather pants, the very traditional Tyrolean things. In Tokyo, women start to go again with a kimono and so on. You see the fascination of the allure of traditional things, which I respect very much, but the risk of Europe is that the danger of globalization, of great numbers, of changing in power is so big that you risk to do an architecture which is a little bit too restricted to European sensibility. I have a lot of friends, which I admire very much, Sergi Zombates and Adam Caruso St. John in London, a lot of people in contemporary Europe who do this sort of banal, a little bit, not decorative, they go back to certain use of materials, almost to decoration, and the idea that buildings should not be seen so much. In a way, it's also a reaction to parametricism, to spectacular, which we saw it went really in a commercial way. So, in a way, we are leaving deconstructionism and parametricism to the Emirates, and in Europe, we are doing buildings which, in a way, they don't reject some kind of feeling that you already saw, some kind of vintage feeling, which I don't dismiss.
I'm asking because especially Caruso St. John, they have kind of an ornament in their buildings. But I'm asking about this keeping a tradition because the Milan or the whole Italy was built in stone. A lot of craftsmen, they have done a lot of like good jobs. And that's something what kind of disappeared in the 90s. Or in 80s or 90s, and now we are kind of discovering that a little bit. I would say it's improving, but it's really tough to do it in a really good quality materials. So that's the question: how are we going to do it? Because it leads to some plasters, non-durable materials. So that's the question: how are you doing this?
You have a book recently published by Taschen, I don't remember, it's called Entryways of Milano. You have all these beautiful pictures, a photographer who went to see the condominiums, the residential condominiums, and the entry have marble, they have a very nice stair detail. In the end, you even have an appendix with a lithologist who tells what are all the stones used. Many times when I go to see the Milano from the 1920, Muzio, Portaluppi, and so on, and also after the war. I live in a house designed by this actually Jewish architects called Fratelli Lattis, the Lattis brothers, who is a kind of precious modernism with beautiful stones, incredibly details. The door is made out of bronze. So it's modernist in look, but the craftsmanship is amazing. And the problem is that in the buildings I do today, nothing of that kind could be reached. We have very, very good craftsmen in Italy. Also, we export them. I was in Paris and I heard speaking Venetian dialect. And actually, there were workers who were doing Kazuko Seiji Manu Samaritan edition. And I heard them many times. This craftsmanship is very appreciated in Europe. And a lot of Italian glass workers, bricklayers, stone people are used all over Europe because of this quality. So we do have the craftsmanship. But in my experience, the quality we are talking about can be only today applied to rather expensive projects. And in the, for example, social housing I'm doing, we use mostly, we also use bricks or so for the facade, but the budget allows you also to do what we call it overcoat insulation with plaster. So basically you put all the insulation on the outside of the wall, you put a net, some kind of grid, and then you put plaster, which it gives high thermal performance. I don't think it's so ecological, to be sincere, because you can recycle but not dismantle it in a way. And also I think it would not last. So the techniques of a contemporary construction field is much, much lower. I don't know if the building we're building today, so we talk a lot about energy conservation, but if the embedded energy, if a building only lasts 20 years and not 200 years, if you go in the Paris Haussmann, the Haussmann quarters in Paris, maybe they're replastered, but the building is still there for 200 years, 300 years. And they still work in a way. I don't think contemporary building will last that long. I see buildings that also after 10 years, they start having a lot of problems, things falling down, or even if they're high technology. That's why I'm not nostalgic, because I think the socio-economical technological condition which produced the architecture in Milano, you're talking between the 50s and 70s, which I adore, they cannot be reproduced anymore. So I think the lesson from the masters should never become a mere copy, because there's some kind of deeper essence that it needs to be there. Otherwise, it's only a formal copy.
Exactly what you are talking about. That's something what I also hear quite often. Oh, today, it's impossible to do it again. And this reminds me that the architecture is going backwards or something. How is this possible? Is architecture moving forward or are we going backwards when we are not able to do something what we were able to do 20 years ago?
That's a very good question also, because in certain moments, we have a feeling of naturality of traditional settlements in Europe, country houses, but I'm saying really where the cows stayed, not the rich people houses, you know, bricks or the traditional architecture, this architecture without architects who Bernard Rudowski was talking about, which was generated by plain culture. There's a famous essay by Adolf Loos. It's called Architecture. It's 1910. And he says, let me take you on the banks of a mountain, lake. Everything is beautiful. The sky is blue. Everything is look like is made by God. And even the traditional houses, they look like were placed there by God. And then something disturbs the landscape. What is it? The villa by the architect. Adolf Loos says, why? Whether it's a good or bad architect, the villa by the architect destroys the landscape. The traditional houses do not destroy, and not even the boat designed by the engineer, he says, because the architect has the Kunstwollen, the will of our art. He's an eradicated. So in the end, what I'm trying to say is that when you go around Europe, prefabricated concrete warehouses, this is the way we build today. I'm saying that we are nostalgic about the way farmers work, but they were not more intelligent or artsy than us, just they use bricks. That's why I'm a bit pessimistic. So again, in a way, we are generating a lot of very mediocre architecture, and then we go to what is called the archistars, and we want to be surprised by them. So I think it's a world who accept boredom, everyday boredom, and then Saturday night, you want to have Saturday night fever, get very excited. I don't like this dichotomy between accepting very low level of landscape. Landscape, I'm saying also built landscape in the peripheries. The typical European suburb is quite without qualities. You can live there, but then you have fantastic TV. So in a way, if you need the beauty, you go into the historical center. In a way, people live in a sort of mediocre landscape. They have a fantastic TV. They have a fantastic iPhone. They have a fantastic car. They accept a sort of house. And then if they need beauty, they go to the center of, you know, the cities. But then maybe there was a famous saying by Archigram in the Osaka Fair. Do we need the city still? The cities were places where people communicated. Maybe today, the way we communicate today, we don't need anymore the market square, because the market square was also a place where you go do gossip. So it's not only to buy vegetables, but the cities were environments where people could talk to each other. Today, maybe the phenomenon of the city was weakened by information technology, I think.
There are some theories which I heard a couple of times. One of the reasons why are we doing mediocre architecture could be that our requirements are not that high. Because if the people would have bigger requirements for their living, for the space where are they living, also the architecture would have the bigger standards because of the expectations and requirements. What do you think about that?
Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher, once said, we don't have to forget that the game has rules, but also a juice, a goal. Today, we all talk about quality. Oh, quality here, quality, quality. But then when you try to agree what quality is, it's more difficult. We substitute the concept of quality with the concept of procedure. Since people do not in the end really agree what quality is in a more cultural sense, we think that if the procedure is good, then the result is good, which means we made a lot of rules, which are rules to combat fire danger, rules to favor people with, you know, the wheelchairs, rules about safety. We architects today, we assemble rules. All these rules are good. The goal of these rules is good. But they tend to transform into standards how, you know, the steps of a stair should be, how this should be, how the handrail should be, how the grill should be, that in the end, they almost cancel the possibility of architecture as a synthetic way. So I spent 80% of my time dealing with these rules. I do it all the time because that's the way you do it. I'm not against any of them, just that half of the bad things of the project as a kind of whole is destroyed by this analysis of the rules. So the fire extinguisher has to be 1 meter 50. In a way, the rule is blind. It was done for a goal, but then it forgets the goal and only gives prescriptions. In this sense, the expectation or requirements you are talking about, they are what people expect a dignified thing to be, like what to expect from a car, from a dress, for something. But it's true that paradoxically, I see buildings which are much more safe, secure, accessible, but in terms of architectural quality, but I'm talking about environmental quality also, the bad. For example, you have to destroy a lot of buildings which are very good and maybe they're not so well insulated from the 30s or the 50s or old buildings. I'm doing a lot of renovations and many times I'm forced to destroy the old window frames, which were, from the craftsman point of view, very beautiful because they don't have the insulation standards. But if I put a PVC, double, triple glass insulation today, I totally destroy that building. Of course, the performances are much higher. In Italy, we are destroying the fabric of the historical city because the state gave some tax advantages to people to redo the facades if they demonstrate they get a higher energy standards. But this created a disaster in the architecture of the cities. We are destroying facades from 30 years ago, which are really, the way we're architecturally very nice, they made the fabric of the city. So my answer is that architecture is anyway a social game. It's not an art, an autonomous art. I also teach in the university. And what the fatigue I'm doing with young kids is to say, okay, we are in this class. In a way, you can do what you want. You have to please me as a professor. But that's not the point. I want to prepare you to go out in the world and be able to explain, defend, and modify your project in relationship with a very complex system of money, of expectations, of rules. If you're not able to do that, you're not an architect. You're somebody who will do a drawing and paste it on your bedroom. Because the only way for architecture to become real is that goes through all the exams. So I'm trying to prepare my students for the hardships of professional life. Even I don't think the university should be a professional school, but I see many universities, they create theories which are so abstract that the students go out in the real world, they got totally destroyed. I don't like that. You cannot think of architecture as an autonomous game.
Are you successful somehow, at least to prepare them for the reality?
There's a song by Cat Stevens. Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world, you know, out there. So if you go to military school or you teach theory of windsurfing, you have the theoretical part, which can be very useful, but then you have to jump in the water and balance on your windsurf. You go in the combat and you have to shoot. I mean, it's different, the West Point thing. So I think in the end, only I'm very empirical. In my professional work, I'm very empirical. Even I was just with a client 1 hour ago and we were talking about, you know, in a way, we're doing housing, the dimensions of an apartment, the way the terra should be. There are market issues. They have to sell it. And I'm very conscious of that. On the other side, I don't consider myself a commercial architect. I hope not. Commercial art is only pleasing the client. So once you please the client, your job is done. Okay. So the essence of commerce is, you know, to sell in a way or to please. I think we are pursuing values which are not just client satisfaction. I think a good building has some kind of deeper essence without being too philosophical in a Louis Kahn's sense. Louis Kahn was almost mystical at a certain moment. I'm not, of course, on that. But I'm saying that when you see something good, is the thing that tells you is good. It's not just how many likes you get on Facebook. I remember some days ago shouting in my studio to young people. I said, stop, basta. Of course, we have to have a meeting with a client and this meeting has to go well. Of course, we have to pass the building permission by the comune. But it's not only that. We never talk about what you think of your own building. You're always there catching the approval of others. But if you try to just please everybody and that's only your goal, it's not enough. To me, you are pleasing a deeper standard, which is some kind of consistency of the building itself.
And could you tell us where is this balance between to please him? Because when you are working with the money of your client, of course, the project should be in, let me say, green numbers somehow. It doesn't need to be profit 40%. It's maybe 20%. I don't know. But how to find this balance?
Auguste Perret used to say, the architect is somebody who builds the permanent through the impermanent, let's say, transitorial. He considered the program transitory and the building permanent. In terms of ecology, I think when you cut a very good space, so I try to embed in my building, let's call it resilience, let's call it robustness, let's call it flexibility or well cut. I think if you do a good architecture, of course you can transform a stadium into a primary school, but good buildings, they have much more embedded flexibility than bad buildings. That's the reason some of the cities we inherited. Otherwise, if the city would be only a machine, each generation should destroy it after 30 years. So answering your question again, in a way, I respond to a client and his needs, but my goal is longer, is long durée. Has to do with urbanity. Maybe has to do with some kind of sophistication he's not obliged to see. Let me make an example. Toy Story 3. Pixar movie, I cried at the sea, or Cinderella by Walt Disney are incredibly good pop productions. You take small kids to see, but they are full of very, very sophisticated references that only I can understand. In Toy Story 3, you have a toy, which is a Fisher-Price telephone. No kid today doesn't not even know where for. I remember it was 3-4 years ago I got around. So the Toy Story 3 people made something only Chino Zucchi can understand, somebody in my generation. This is fantastic. So I enjoy taking, not a kid anymore, I'm waiting for grandsons to see Toy Story 3, and I enjoy it because it's full of resonances, and even Cinderella is full of sophistication. So what I like about ancient architecture, like a church, is that it can respond to very basic needs of, you know, religion, but also can have very high-level speculative things. That's why I enjoy Ben and Sebastian. I have 100,000 iTunes song. I'm a big culture of indie music. And I think a song should please the first times you hear it, but more and more you hear it, you discover small passages. This is what I like about sophisticated pop. So in a way, my ideal of architecture is not so far from sophisticated pop or indie music.
The clients, which are you talking about, are they accepting that? Because they kind of see the project sometimes with the not that long time span than you, as you are talking about. Do they accept this approach?
That's why I have to give it as a gift to them, not make them spend more money. If they don't see that as a quality, as a selling quality, they don't care. So if I do it at the same price and without disturbing that, they don't mind. In a way, they're not against me because their goal is economical in a way. This does not mean that my client cannot like what I do. Okay, they do like it. But in a way, I'm a service to them, you know, for their own goal. So again, if I think my goal is way too far from them, I will have to make them spend three times the money or whatever, I will not accept the professional task. But I'm old enough to understand when they come to me. For example, the client just went away. They're saying, we're selling apartments and 2,000. I ask them, what is your selling price in Padova? 2,500, maybe a little bit higher quality, 3,000. The Bosco Verticale by my friend Stefano Boeri is 15, 20,000 a square meter. So is 8 times more, which means in the end that I know that if I take a commission where the final budget is that, the construction price cannot be more than maybe 1,500, depends on what kind of surface you calculated, and I cannot build it in gold. I'm also used to Boris Podrecka. I met him many years ago because at the Jungans competition I won over him. I felt a bit guilty. He said, when I go to the client the first day, I ask him, do you want a Jesuit church or a Franciscan church? In the sense that, you know, to understand what they expect. Sometimes people, they need sophistication. I mean, so again, not being too commercial, but you have to understand the rules of the game. I always said to my clients, if you call the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger can do Lady Jane or Let's Spend the Night Together. You cannot ask the Rolling Stones to do Beyoncé, I don't know, whatever it takes, but they still have a range. That's why I like Herzog de Meuron, because they always find the right character. Probably their standard is higher in terms of budget than me, of course. But then they have this freshness of finding a new game. You discover each other. You are a little bit suspicious at the beginning, then you learn how to play together.
A couple of times you already mentioned the word ecology and sustainable design. So how are you trying to make your project ecological and sustainable?
I had a very young experience at MIT. I studied there from 75 to 78 or 9. Actually, I went to MIT because I read the famous book, The Limits to Growth, wrote by Donella Meadows in 73, which was the first serious book on the ecological disaster we're going through. So I went there because I consider myself an ecological at the first time, much before sustainability ecology came as a marketing device also. I remember design, I'm very, very careful in designing well materials. But on the other side, today is so difficult to distinguish what is really the essence of it and the marketing issues. So I hear so much, I use a bad word, bullshit from my friends. Having a very scientific education in terms of physics, chemistry, and that, half of the building they are advertised as sustainable are totally unsustainable, and you can manipulate very much data. First thing. So I am very engaged in that, and you have many different issues about, you know, materials, production. For example, concrete today, certainly, I was discussing the other day with the engineer, steel and concrete. The method of realizing concrete today is a lot of energy consumption, okay? Because the heat to make the cement is very high. So on the other side, it can durate more. So we were discussing in terms of ecology, in terms of using steel, aluminum, or wood, for example. For example, there's a lot of fashion in wood, but the resin you use in wood today to glue the wood together is not very ecological. And wood has maintenance problem in structure, has a lot of, apart from acoustical problems, but many, many, many. Everybody thinks wood is ecological and it's not. Just to say that, I tend to evaluate things deeply. As I said before, I think duration, in my view, I never separate the ecological issue from the cultural urban issue. To me, environments also have to last in time. So I do feel durability is a very important issue. I tend to embed as much as I can. And sadly, I think that we have to distinguish an ethical attitude. Every time one of my son gets out of a room, I said, switch off the light, you know, because that's ethics, individual ethics we all should have. Or maybe don't use plastic or so on. But sadly, if we want to talk about the real impact of what we do on the world, the four things are really they matter about if you want to really reduce CO2 are, one, the number of population. When I was born, we were 3 billion on the Earth. Now we're 8 billion. So more than double in my lifetime. Two, globalization of the market. To build a portello, there's a typical granite in the Milano area, and my construction company bought it 3 times from China because it was much, much cheaper. It went all the way from China, even it was a typical, exactly the same granite. And he said, I can import it 10 times from China and throw it into the sea, it's still cheaper. So globalization of production, it means everything we wear today is not produced in Italy or in Europe, not this close. Third, traveling with planes, because I calculated, you know, let's say if I go to St. Petersburg and come back, I do 1 ton of CO2, and means that if I do 10 travels a year like this, I double my carbon imprint just because I'm European. I say each person in Europe goes from, say, 10 to 20 CO2 tons per inhabitants. So Mali or Laos is 0.4. So every European consumes, puts CO2 80 times Laos, which means, sadly, we want to really save the world, we go back poor. Our standard of living is unecological. So the real, if you talk about effects, I'm not saying building does not count, but what will make really the CO2 things is what China and India will do and not what the Danish people will do or we personally will do. In that sense, this does not mean I don't have a very deep ethics of it, but to say you're saving the world just by putting some trees on your balconies or biting the Freitag things, I think is bullshit. That's why sometimes I am very ecological, but I tend to have a strong reaction on the ecological lies I hear, which are very big.
Let me ask you also a couple of questions from Milan, because we are now in Milan. You spent the whole life here, kind of. I spent 1 month in Milan. First question, from your point of view, is the Milan good city for the living?
I like Milano. I had, you know, the thing is that when you travel, if I go to Stockholm or New York or Tokyo, I make a funny metaphor. To go to Stockholm is having like a love affair. And to stay in a city means marrying. It's two different things. So some cities are very fascinating as a tourist. And maybe you would perceive them differently if you would live there. I love Venice. The question is, would I like to live in Venice or New York? I have a lot of New York friends. When I go to New York, I absolutely get almost drugged in New York by the city, but maybe I don't know if I would live there. So I like to live in Milano because it's a middle-sized city. When the tourists become so many more than the people, sometimes you go around the streets, you even get oppressed. So the city becomes like a big market, like Florence is this way. So Florence is beautiful, but the historical center is just like a big market. So I like that Milano has a lot of beautiful cool things. I also almost was an historian. I wrote a very scholarly book on Milanese courtyards, which is now on my desk, when I was young. So in the end, I like it as quality of living because of its scale. is big enough to be a metropolis, but not so big to have really the big metropolis scale. I'm not saying it's the only, I love many other European cities mostly. I'm affectionate to Europe in general. Each European city is beautiful because of a singularity of character, and I love to move 200 kilometers and the landscape changes.
Because after 1 month of my discovering the city of Milan, I noticed one, let me say, very negative stuff, that the Milan is a very, very car-oriented city. And last year, I spent 2 months in Barcelona living there. It's totally different in a question of public space. And for example, here in Milan, I visited couple of spaces where the architecture is creating a potential space, like for the public space, but it's ruined with cars. It's just full of cars, no trees. And I see really big potential there everywhere in the city. How you see this? Because this makes the city very car-oriented and not people-oriented.
It is true. The mayor of Milano and all the deputy mayors are working very much in these directions. On two scales. One was even called tactical urbanism, is something a bit fashionable, just go into this kind of spaces almost just by painting the ground and reappropriating the car space. This is a temporary thing which gives meaning without changing very much, but also where they're redoing a lot of public spaces and squares, putting a lot of bike lanes, which Milano really lacked. If you go to the Northern Europe, sometimes it's even too much. When I go to Holland, I'm almost afraid, because if I'm an Italian tourist and I'm standing looking up in the air on a bike lane, I could be killed by this crazy. So in a way, I like the public space of being a little bit of everybody and not too much the bike lane, this and that and that. I like bike lanes, but in a suburban way. But once you get to a city, I would like a paved city where the king is the pedestrian and the bikes and not the cars. We are really going to this direction. For example, a lot of cars in Milano park under trees because where it's not paved, there was no law. So you find all these boulevards. But we are doing a lot of projects and a lot has to be done yet. So your analysis is totally right. Barcelona was very, very smart and even seminal in the when they did the Olympics in the 80s. They really start from redoing the public space, let's say. So not only they redid the city, but also they started from the redesign of public spaces. They had a lot of Lisbon Square. Also in this sort of intermediate state between pure landscaping and architecture in a sense of paving of this. I think Barcelona experience was very important also to as an attitude the way you design. For example, Madrid, I was totally astonished how a big project from the 80s and 90s called the Madrid River Rio totally changed the landscape of Madrid in a very big scale. They made a beautiful garden, a pedestrian space where they had, say, an inner city highway. To me, that's one of the best urban design project. It was partially done by West 8, but also by a big team of Ginés Garrido there. So it was a mixture between foreign designers and there, because it was very, very comprehensive space.
But that's a pity, because exactly what they're talking about. I'm going through the street, really nice big trees, which are already there. So the job is already done. It's only about to putting cars away, put the nice pavement, and that's enough. And that's it. You don't need to wait like 80 years for the trees. Yeah. So it seems to me like quite an easy job, but it needs some concept for the whole city and start doing that.
Yeah. Last night, I live in a historical center. Last night, I was coming home, and I think it was a Russian person renting some Airbnbs, and he asked me, where can I park my car? I said, this is a yellow line only for living people. If you go the blue line, then underground parking. I tried to explain to him where he could park his car here, right? I don't think you can, even if my four kids do not go around by car, I only use the Vespa. I never use the car in Milano, but I'm lucky because, you know, I can use the Vespa to go away. If you think of a metropolis, you cannot completely avoid the idea that all the single people moving around, you can discourage cars of commuters because they come with public transportation. But the city is made of so many micro travel, of even in terms of work, that I'm for a car-free city, but you have to take in account, you have to put the car somewhere. So you cannot just prohibit them as your job. So the job of the administration is also maybe underground parkings, maybe give services. So the problem of cars is not just solved by canceling it.
I think the public transportation in Milan is quite good.
It's good,
I really appreciate it. Yeah. But in a couple of European cities, you have quite strong parking policy, for example, London or in Bratislava in Slovakia. A couple of years ago, our mayor started to push the parking policy. And we were, let me say, in the same state as you are now, but after just 1 year, people got used to the parking policy and the city is much clearer with the cars.
Bratislava, by the way, is a beautiful city. I really was planning to go back. I visited so many years ago.
And I kind of don't see it here because when I see the mess of the cars there, that you have some rules with the white parking, blue parking and the yellow parking. Yeah, I see that. But I don't see the much stronger regulations here. But that could be like step by step. Yeah, I can see it. But when we were mentioning the Barcelona and the Olympics, like they had the Olympics in 1992, and before that, they very conceptually changed the city, and they saw the opportunity to improve the public spaces and their quality. The Milan today is in a very similar situation because in 2026 you will have the Winter Olympics in Cortina and Milan. So let me ask you if you see some conception that the Milan is somehow transforming and using this opportunity to become the better city, as Barcelona okay. did.
The issue can be taken at different scales. At the, let's say, bigger scale, a lot of European cities transformed, let's say, the inner cities, not the expansion. For example, the big keys of redesign, not just a single piece, but also a comprehensive things, were the infrastructural areas dismissed, like railway yards and big industrial precincts. We did, as we did in Venice, and it's not so easy to urban design in Venice because Venice is given. So in Milano, we did the Alfa Romeo Portello area. In Helsinki, we designed many years ago the urban renovation of Skolkeski Pasila. If I go back, many urban design occasions were done by dismissed areas which were had infrastructure and had a single property. This is happening also in Milano. We recently participated in a very complex process which is called the railway yards. So in Porta Romana, where actually they're building the housing for the Olympics, the Olympic Village is called. In Farini, two or three very big railway yards, which the railway does not need anymore at that scale. So they were transforming them into city parts. So the answer is yes. As I said before, the infrastructure is there. The only thing that half of the thing for the Olympics are thought as something that could stay for the city always. Half of them are a bit like this. For example, we also had the Expo in 2015, which also changes the image of Milano for things. And now the site of the Expo, they're redoing urbanizations. A lot of times when you have the expos is what happens after the post-Expo. like in Hanover or London or so. So to plan the site, and the experience tell us that the single infrastructure, like in Torino, they had the Olympics in, I remember when, some infrastructures, they work, some not so much, because if you only do a palace, you know, a sport thing, then you have to tell. So what I like of the expo is the possibility to have a longer view in terms of what is the result of the expo in terms of permanent result. A lot of areas in Barcelona, the area of the expo of the 1906, well, you know, the Barcelona Pavilion by Bisbal de Roo, like this. Milano is doing, especially in Porta Romana and Santa Giulia, the expo pieces are the motors of urban, say, redevelopment. Sometimes the rush, the risk is that the real estate people can a bit play on it. So to say, oh, we need this quick. They give to the public maybe the arena, and then they do a big in a way, real estate operation, but then the results are not always as satisfactory. So they use the sports event as a pretext of acceleration to get easier things. I think the main problem is that in the late 1800, the public administration built on the parks, the prisons, the hospitals, the bibliotheques. So it was the main motor of the public infrastructure. Today, many times, the present financial state of the public is not so good. So the public does not have all the money to be put to really redo the new city. So in a way, they have to use private capital to do it. So in Milano, you know, since the public has not that much money, they do to a private, okay, if you do X percent of social housing, let's talk about, for example, social housing, which is a big issue in Milano, because Milano, it's an expensive city, but then the young people, they do not find rent where they can afford. So Milano has a problem today that a lot of students or young professionals, they cannot afford the percentage of their salary which goes into rent is 80, 90, even 100%. Somebody working in my studio, especially young generation, they don't get that much money. And in the end, the rents in Milano are so high that they tend to, I don't know exactly, but to find a decent place, they spend like 80% of the salary in the rent, which is not right.
But is it because of the lacking of those spaces?
Is it between the balance between the cost of living and, for example, I have a person who graduated with me, very good young person, just graduated, and he found a place in Enzo de Meuron studio. I think he gets 5,000 francs a month, just graduated, which is totally, is at least five times what, if he would be lucky, he would like get in Milano, five times more. Of course, you know, to go back and forth, life is more costly, but it's still five times. Probably he would be lucky. A young architect in Milano, a freshman university, can get 800 a month or 1,000 maybe, but when it was really like, yeah, just out of the university, just to compare it. But just to say that we have this problem of social housing and student housing, which in Milano has very much in this moment.
Let's go to the regular rubric at the end, because we are moving forward. Question number one. What is your the most favorite failure?
I just had an interview for a magazine. I gave it the title, Fail, Fail Again, Fail Better, which is a quote by Samuel Beckett. I do believe in fail, 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 fail as a method, I would say. Without failure, or you would not never progress. The problem is who pays for the failure. So probably I learned more from the failures in my life than from my successes. This is sounds a bit like, you know, an internet feel-good thing, but it's true. I really believe that. And all the projects which made me grow, they were the most difficult ones. I just went yesterday, I was in Venice, and I went back to see my projects, the one in the Jungans. And after 20 years, the climate in Venice is very bad. So some of them took the test of time. Some of them, some minimalist elements I put. For example, I remember that time, 20 years ago, not wanting the stone sills from the windows going out of the facade, because I like all this sort of flush aesthetic. I did not do a very overhanging of the roof. So a lot of the aesthetics of modernism, taking away the overhang of the roof, the minimalist detail, let's say, is very, very, very bad for construction. Waters happen, so if you don't overlap things. So there is an intrinsic conflict between the minimalist aesthetics of architects and good construction practice. This I learned on my things, because I insisted with construction company to not make the sill overhang at the bottom of a window. And then after 2-3 years, I was forced to see that the dirt who would accumulate on the horizontal part of the sill whenever it rains went down into the facade. So today I would not. I tend to pursue still some kind of dry, clean aesthetics, but with good construction. With not just saying, okay, I wanted this to disappear. And also, again, going to these aesthetics, you need some overlap between things because of that, what you could call the tolerances of construction. Young people born with AutoCAD, they see the drawing, but they don't understand why things are... They take a detail from Renzo Piano, they copy it, but they have no idea that those lines represent a knowledge. So in a way, they cut and paste without understanding what they're cutting and paste. So I don't know if I have a gigantic failure, otherwise I would not be here, you know, death like this. But many micro failure tell us how to be robust and resilient, I would say. And I do believe in failure. And many times, and many things you learn on your own body, I would even say, or professional body.
What is your the most negative personal quality?
Last night, my wife, she's also an architect, said, Chino, you always want too much for yourself. You know, you always always a bit with other people, they always feel they can never be good enough. But, and I said, yes, Rafael Moneo said something very important. I do not ask of other people what I do not ask to myself. I'm very, very self-critical. I think every project should get to the best. And when I'm of a bad humor, is because I don't think the project got to the root of what it could get. And sometimes people feel this tension. I do it also myself. I don't ask too much of other people. I just ask too much of everybody, including myself. The question is, many times my standards are so high that people, they ever feel like judged, or because I'm not very authoritarian. I'm very easygoing, but I cannot stand even small mistakes in text or writing or things like that. So this, I tend to have a very analogic mind. Maybe some ADHD people have that a bit. They jump from one thing to the other. This is something which really gives richness to my projects, but then many times I can be a bit anecdotal or dispersive. I heard somebody who worked with Steve Jobs, and the iPod Classic was already in the shops and he was displeased with the click, the sound. He made it took away from the shops and it took 6-7 months to find the right click. Steve Jobs was a totally obsessive person. But then, you know, so he made the standard of design that we admire. So sometimes this negative attitude in terms of personal things, I think a lot of great people, they would not stop where other people would stop. I think Francesca Torzo, she's the best absolutely Italian architect. And many people who work with her, they consider her too tough or obsessive. I mean, if you hear from the collaborators, I admire some people. And then you hear, you know, from the corporation, the hell. I have my assistant, she just work at Sana, Kazuko Sejima, and said, the Japanese are crazy. You stay there until 10 o'clock in the night and so and so.
What is your best personal quality?
I think irony. I always said the most intelligent people I met in my life, they're also the most ironic, self-ironic many times. When people are too serious or convinced, I'm suspicious. You have Taras Bengelun says, the contrary of sapere, of knowledge is not ignorance. The contrary of knowledge is certainty. The market requires to you a lot of, that's the way you do it, of guru people, of, you know, so TED Talk people who, you know, they promise you the idea. I think that irony is, especially self-irony, be ironic about yourself also, it's like a lubricant, some kind of oil who made the world run. So I would not have survived all the troubles I had in my life without some kind of acceptance and self-irony.
Flat or house?
I like to live in flats, given you have a big terrace. I think today we all would love a lot of private space, but I'm a very urban person. So in the end, I would like an urban flat more than a suburban house. Even if the house, you can have a lot of resources you don't have in a flat.
What is your the most favorite food?
I think pasta is a universal food because it's very, very simple, but changing the sauce, you can change everything. So it's like, it's with endless possibilities, the food of endless possibility. And pizza is also very, maybe it's too nationalistic, but I think pasta and pizza are great inventions both because they're easy to do. Everybody can do them. What I like about Italian cuisine is that you don't have a distinction between high and low. Regional cuisine can be very, very good.
Mm-hmm. But do you have one favorite one from the pasta or just general?
If I would be nationalistic about being from Milano, it would be risotto con ossobuco, yellow rice with marrow bone. But also tonnarelli cacio e pepe is more a Tuscany thing, cacio is a kind of cheese and pepper is pepper and they also have some pancetta, some bacon in it. So.
Okay, let me ask you a candy question. Before our recording, you had an opportunity to try Kavenky and Kakaoerezi. Those are the candies, very typical one in Slovakia. So which one Chinotsuki prefers, Kavenky or Kakaoerezi?
I will go to the Kakaoerezi one with the pure chocolate, not the one with the coffee.
Okay.
What about you?
I totally love Kavenky, okay, so the second one. Okay. So let me ask you the final question. It's more connected to the fashion, but I'm sure that you kind of know it. We, like an architects, we like to wear black clothes. And why do you think that architects wear black?
So I actually don't like to wear black as an architect. And I even have a joke, where is the funeral? No, we are architects on a site visit. So I personally do not wear black, but I would not wear black, but I don't know why. I tend. There's a song by Leonard Cohen, it's called The Famous Blue Raincoat. So I think I'm a blue person more than a black person. In terms of dressing,
it's totally fine. But don't you have a reason why are you not wearing black?
To be sincere, I find it a bit like a uniform of architects, especially because not only they wear black, but they wear like a jacket without shirt, but there's a black t-shirt, something. So I don't like that. But maybe I have to say that since my grandfather is a partisan, I tend, in Italy, camicia nera, black shirt, it was the fascists. So maybe I'm not, I tend to be a liberal, but certainly not fascist. So I probably my age, black, where the little young fascists used to wear black. Maybe I have some kind of political overtone I inherit from my partisan. Because camicia nera, black shirt, in Italy means you're fascist.
Okay, but it's 70 years ago.
Yes, but the nostalgic today, they go and, you know, they make the fascist saluto with a hand. They wear black too.
Okay, so we are at the end of this podcast. Let me thank you very much, Chino, that you found the time for it and you shared your ideas and your approaches to architecture and also to the Milan city. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm also very honored to be in this podcast, because I know it's also very successful. A lot of people hear it. So it's interesting to talk to people you don't know, and maybe they just click by chance, and maybe they're interested in what they hear saying, and maybe they go and listen to it. So thank to everybody also for your patience.